When it comes to fitness, what's real? How about when it really, truly fits your life? That's how Anytime Fitness sees it. Because our coaches see you. It's how they build personal plans that work wherever you are and focus on everything that matters, from fitness to nutrition to recovery, all so you can push yourself further than ever or just through the next rep. It's total 360 support for a real difference. That's Anytime Fitness. That's real AF. Visit anytimefitness.com.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. As Asian superpowers go, China gets a lot of attention. India often seems like the also-ran big tiger. But President Obama just spent several days in India, wooing Indian industry, Indian politicians, and Indian popular opinion, the longest foreign visit of his presidency. There's a message here. This hour on Point, India and the U.S. and what Washington sees in India when it looks into Asia's future. In a moment, we will hear from New Delhi and more. But first, we follow the president to Indonesia, where he's just dodged volcanic ash to fly into Asia's biggest Muslim nation. Jake Tapper, senior White House correspondent for ABC News, joins us from the Indonesian capital of Jakarta. Jake Tapper, thanks very much for being with us.
Sure, it's my pleasure.
So did you see the ash plume from Mount Merapi as you flew in, Jake?
I was sleeping.
Okay.
You don't get very many opportunities to sleep on these trips, so you grab them when you can. And I was pretty passed out during the plane ride. Sorry.
It's a quick visit to Indonesia because of that ash, I guess, and difficulties flying in and out of Jakarta right now. What's the president hope to accomplish in Indonesia apart from visiting the land where he spent 4 years as a boy?
Not really much of a visit. He's not going to get to do any sightseeing. He's not going to go back to his old school or to any of his old haunts from when he was 6 to 10, which is would be years that he spent here. He met with the president of Indonesia, the first democratically elected president, who was reelected just last year, and then he is going to be giving a speech. Basically, it's a follow-up speech to the major address he gave in Cairo last year. To the Muslim world. And then, as you mentioned, the schedule is changing right now because of the concern about the ash plume. And I think they're taking a couple things off the schedule. So as of now, all I know is that they're doing this speech in which the president will be holding up Indonesia as an example. A democracy and a country that respects pluralism and other religions as an example to the Muslim world of what can be.
And what about the India visit, Jake, the longest of this of President Obama's presidency? What is the White House team saying about how that visit went?
Well, they're pretty pleased. They were pitching the story of the trip very much as almost like an international stimulus plan. Lots of deals were being made that were finalized, and when President Obama arrived, he was able to announce about $10 billion worth of deals, 20 deals of India buying U.S. goods, such as 10 airplanes purchased from Boeing and other deals like that. And then, of course, there was a lot of negotiation about trying to open up U.S. markets even further. And then on the last day, President Obama announced to the Indian Parliament that he was going to support their bid for a permanent seat on the United Nations Security Council. As you know, there's talk of reconstituting the UN Security Council, so there would be more than 5 permanent seats. And the president basically is now supporting India getting one of those permanent seats. It's not something that India's nemesis and neighbor Pakistan was happy about, but it was something that the president felt strongly about, and I think White House aides feel pretty good about the trip, both in terms of how it was perceived by the Indians and also just what was accomplished in terms of solidifying a stronger relationship with Prime Minister Singh and the country at large.
Jake, what do we know about conversations, public or private, about the war in Afghanistan, Afghanistan generally, and how India might help the United States and Afghanistan get stability there, maybe help the U.S. get out?
Well, I mean, this is something that is also part of the trip here in Jakarta, which is trying to get more countries to contribute more in terms of training, in terms of soldiers, in terms of the international effort. And as of now, I mean, India does contribute to the war effort there, much to the chagrin of Pakistan, which sees it as India trying to surround Pakistan. But it's also part of the trip here where there's talk of Indonesia also contributing something, probably more in terms of training. These are parts of the mission here, even though the focus has been on economics.
And finally, Jake, what about the shadow of China over this visit to India? Does the White House speak of the U.S. relationship with India in relationship to China as a counterweight to China? How is it described?
They don't talk about it, I haven't heard them disagree with any of the analysts that we've trotted out or pointed out in our pieces that obviously a strong U.S.-India relationship and the U.S. trying to encourage India to become more strong, more powerful, both as a regional power and also giving India a voice, a stronger voice, theoretically, in the United Nations Security Council, that all would be a counterbalance to China, which, of course, is a very strong force in Asia. I don't think there's any disagreement about that. They just don't talk about it as the reason for what they're doing. But obviously, India, and Indonesia for that matter, but India as the world's largest democracy, a country that often sees eye-to-eye with the U.S. on foreign policy, having a strong India, the U.S. doesn't definitely perceives as in the U.S. interest. And I guess there are two different ways to look at it vis-a-vis China. One is that it's a counterbalance to China, as you say, both to have a regional, not a rival, but another force in the region that is a strong power economically or another force on the U.N. Security Council, but also that it could theoretically drive China to be closer with the U.S., if China perceives the U.S.-India relationship as a rival, perhaps they would do more. That's the hope, anyway, to try to be close to the U.S. as well.
Jake Tapper with the president in Indonesia, just out of the biggest foreign visit of his presidency to India, and soon out of Indonesia as well, ahead of that volcanic ash plume there. Jake Tapper, senior White House correspondent for ABC, thanks so much for being with us, Jake.
Thank you, Tom.
Here's President Obama addressing the Indian Parliament in New Delhi yesterday, part of his 10-day Asian trip to boost business and diplomatic relations in Asia. He stressed the importance here of India-U.S. relations.
It's no coincidence that India is my first stop on a visit to Asia, or that this has been my longest visit to another country since becoming president. For in Asia and around the world, India is not simply emerging. India has emerged. And it is my firm belief that the relationship between the United States and India, bound by our shared interests and our shared values, will be one of the defining partnerships of the 21st century.
President Obama in New Delhi before the Indian Parliament yesterday. Joining us now from New Delhi is Sumit Ganguly. He's professor of political science, holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair in Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University, Bloomington, Indiana. But he's currently in India as a distinguished visiting fellow at the Institute of Defense Studies and Analysis in New Delhi. Sumit Ganguly, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure entirely.
I think you're speaking to us from an Indian military facility. We'll talk about security. Give us your overall sense of the president's visit first. Do Indians see it as a success, Sumit?
They certainly see it as a success, but perhaps as a qualified success. They would have been happier if the president had been more forthright in terms of talking about Pakistan's complicity with terror. But from my standpoint, I think that was an unrealistic expectation. You would hardly expect a visiting head of state who is dependent or whose country is dependent for the prosecution of the war in Afghanistan on Pakistan to publicly condemn that country in its perceived arch enemy. So I think that expectation was somewhat off kilter, and obviously the president did not address that expectation. But that said, there were a number of other matters that your correspondent from ABC News pointed out were of momentous significance, particularly the willingness of the president to at least embrace in part the notion that India would be a natural candidate in an expanded Security Council, a natural candidate for a permanent seat in an expanded Security Council. There were, of course, a whole host of other tangible agreements that were reached during this three-day visit.
Sumit, we just got a minute before the break, but what's your sense? Do these nations have an equal interest in this relationship? Does one have a greater stake than the other in an alliance?
I think neither is expecting an alliance, and India will maintain its prickly independence. It seeks a partnership, and Indians insist a partnership of equals, even though this might be somewhat chimerical, given the extraordinary differences in military capacity, in economic prowess, in political stability, the institutional capacities of the two countries. But nevertheless, at least some notion of equality in a partnership, which is what the Indians crave. And I think for the first time, the United States also sees India as an invaluable partner and not merely as a supplicant.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, the sound there of the President, President Obama, and First Lady Michelle Obama dancing with students in Mumbai in the last few days during the President's big visit to India. We're talking this hour about the United States and India, what the President just accomplished, and what India means for America's Asian future, its global future. We've been joined from New Delhi by Sumit Ganguly, professor at Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana, but right now a distinguished visiting fellow at the Institute of Defense Studies and Analysis in New Delhi, right in the thick of things there. With me in the studio right now is Nicholas Burns, former Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, 05 to 08. That's right up at the top of the U.S. State Department structure. He was in the middle of the negotiations on the U.S.-India civil nuclear agreement. We'll ask him about that. He's also recently co-authored, co-edited a report called Natural Allies, a Blueprint for the Future of U.S.-India Relations, published by the Center for New American Security. Nicholas Burns, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you.
What do you see in this Obama visit to India?
I think it was a very important visit and very successful for President Obama and for the United States because we have a priority relationship with India. It truly is going to be, I think, one of our two or three most important partners in the next 50 or so years. Why is that? Because we have a very important bilateral trade relationship, high-tech corridors between Bangalore and Hyderabad in southern India to 128 in Boston to Silicon Valley in California. India is important in Afghanistan. India will be very important as we seek to manage the rise of China. What do I mean by that? We have to engage China. Mm-hmm.
We are engaged
with China, our most important trade partner, our most important creditor. Mm-hmm. And yet China is causing some concern because of the way it's rising to power, flexing its muscles, perhaps will become the second most important military power in the world. So if the United States can have a close relationship with India, along with our allies, our treaty allies, Japan, South Korea, and Australia, China will rise in an Asia that is democratic, where countries are strong and working together, and therefore
democracies in Japan, in Korea,
yes,
in India, now in Indonesia.
All democracies. Mm-hmm. Exactly right. And so in the great game scheme of things, mm-hmm, in the largest strategic sense, this relationship with India is vital for the United States and for India because we both want to get along with China, but neither wishes to see China have an uncontrolled, especially military, rise to power.
Sumit, how does India look at this? If it is a triangle, look at this triangle. Is it interested in playing a counterweight role with the United States to China? Does it need the United States to sort of keep a balance in Asia as China rises and rises, Sumit?
It would never publicly so admit, but in a very tentative fashion, India is proceeding exactly in the same direction. India has strengthened its ties diplomatically, strategically, militarily with South Korea, with Japan. The military part has been extremely tentative and very incremental. It has mostly involved sort of port visits of Indian ships and the like. But this is hardly accidental. It is taking place against a backdrop of an increasingly assertive and, some would argue, aggressive China, and consequently, without making much fanfare about this, without proclaiming it from the ramparts of the Red Fort in New Delhi, nevertheless, the Indians are subtly moving in the same direction because they are uncertain about the nature and the characteristics of China's rise.
Nick Burns, does the United States throwing an arm around India, in effect, or the president throwing his arm around the prime minister of India, does it provoke China? I mean, after all, China has said many times over many years it wants a harmonious rise. It wants a harmonious emergence as a big power on the world stage. Does this mean the U.S. won't take that at face value, or need it not mean that?
Well, China is not going to like what happened in New Delhi over the last couple of days and in Mumbai during the president's visit. China wants a singular relationship with the United States, does not want to see the United States establishing close relations with a perceived rival. Mm-hmm. China perceives India as a rival. But here's the challenge of diplomacy. We have to balance our interests in Asia. So while we are working with the Chinese in a thousand different ways, especially economically, for the long term, we've got to pay attention to constructing relationships. And I agree with Sumit Ganguly. This won't be an alliance because India is too big and too proud to have a military alliance with the United States.
Your report is called a natural alliance, but you don't mean it in formal terms.
I don't mean it in formal terms, mm-hmm. Exactly. We are treaty allies with Japan and mm-hmm. South Korea. We'll come to their defense if they're attacked. Mm-hmm. I think our relationship will be different with India because India is a real equal to the United States in terms of its size, in terms of its economic power, in terms of its future political power. But balancing these interests is going to be very important because I can think of no question more important for Americans as we look overseas over the next couple of decades. How do we keep the peace in Asia? How do we avoid a conflict with China? We do that by engaging and working with the Chinese, but on the other hand, establishing relationships that can balance and, in some ways, limit Chinese power.
When a lot of Americans think of India, they think of economics and outsourcing. We'll look at that in just a minute. But there are also big issues to the west of India, not the north and east. Sumit, when the president visited Mumbai, he with the First Lady, they sat down with Indian students. Michelle Obama invited them to, you know, ask tough questions, and they did. And they went right away to jihad, to terrorism, and to Pakistan. What about the U.S. relationship? I mean, the U.S. also has a relationship with Pakistan. And what about India when it comes to the war in Afghanistan? Can India help bring stability to that country? Can it help pave the way for the United States to get out? Or does it not want to do that, Sumit? Sumit, are you there? Oh, well, Nicholas, I'll put the question to you.
Talk about balance. Balancing India and Pakistan is another challenge for the United States. And the problem here is that we need Pakistan to be successful in the war in Afghanistan for obvious reasons. And yet India has been very helpful. India is a major donor of assistance projects to Afghanistan. And as an example to the Afghans of what they might become in the future as the Afghans struggle to build a democracy. So the U.S. is caught in the position of having to work with both of them, and yet both of them want the United States to choose, as those students suggested in the questions to President Obama the other day. And so the correct policy is the one that the president's pursuing. Good relations with both, but don't tie everything you do to with one to how the other is going to react. So some of what the president announced the other day, supporting India for Security Council membership, is not going to be received well at all, as it wasn't in Pakistan.
Sumit Ganguly in New Delhi, let me ask you, can the United States have good relations with India and with Pakistan? And does India want peace in Afghanistan? Can it help push for that somehow?
India certainly, in my judgment, has played an extraordinarily constructive role, and no pun intended, in Afghanistan. It has engaged
They've built
in
a lot of buildings.
Construction projects, development projects. Even the prominent Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid has publicly stated that India's developmental assistance to Afghanistan is the most effective. It's either the fifth or the sixth largest donor of assistance to Afghanistan. Indian workers have been shot and killed, the Indian embassy attacked. There is ample evidence of Pakistani complicity in this attack, and I'm referring you to a story in the New York Times, not in the Indian press, about the degree of Pakistani complicity in this attack. But despite that, India has persisted in its efforts to try and stabilize Afghanistan, to promote economic development, to ensure that there is at least some semblance of a democratic order in Afghanistan. And so I see the Indian role as an extraordinarily constructive role and bolstering what the United States would like to accomplish. The problem is that the Pakistan Army has a very different view. It sees India as encircling it by developing outposts in Afghanistan. It sees a kind of a sinister Indian plot to sandwich Pakistan. And no amount of attempts on the part of India to reassure the Pakistani military has proven to be especially useful thus far.
Let's go to Bill in Columbia, South Carolina, hear from our listeners. Bill, you're on the air with Nicholas Burns and Sumit Ganguly.
Hi, Tom. Hi, gentlemen. I appreciate you taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just want to say that just from a layman's point of view, I think that it's a wonderful natural alliance. I think it is perhaps not innate, but born out of history. And I think that it's something that nobody ever says these days, is that it's really, to a layman, part of the function of what was originally the British Empire, and thank God for them. And nobody ever says that. My wife has a small business, and we had some stuff manufactured in China, and it was a disaster. And when we got in trouble, everybody in the Commerce Department pointed out that there are no laws there that we can rely on. But they pointed to India as an example of where we might go for manufacturing, because he says they have a system of Western laws that are dependable and that they have a good infrastructure and well-educated people. And I think it is a wonderful thing for the balance of power over there.
So bravo for that history, you say, Bill, and we hear that. But, Sumit, I wonder how far that goes. Are there red lines in this relationship? If the United States expects too much or pushes too far, how far does history take us here?
No, thus far, I don't think the U.S. has pushed anything too far, and in fact has been extraordinarily circumspect on the one issue that gets the hackles of the Indians very quickly rising, and that is the very vexed question of Kashmir, where India has made its own series of errors and blunders and has paid an extraordinarily high price for its folly in Kashmir. But here the Obama administration, after some initial missteps, has actually been extraordinarily deft in keeping this issue off the front burner, and the president touched it very gingerly in his press conference, which I watched rather avidly yesterday.
I want to bring the economic angle in here because it is enormous. A lot of Americans think outsourcing when they think India, and not necessarily with warm and fuzzy feelings. Eswar Prasad joins us from Ithaca, New York, senior professor of trade policy at Cornell, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, author of the forthcoming Emerging Markets, Resilience and Growth Amid Global Turmoil. Eswar Prasad, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
First of all, to the deals, the big deals the president made or was around for. How big are those deals? We heard Jake Tapper in Jakarta telling us about, airline sales to Boeing, $10 billion worth of business. Is that a big deal in this relationship economically?
These are impressive sounding numbers, but the reality, Tom, is that the nature of the relationship between India and the U.S. is balanced, which is a good thing, unlike the relationship with China, where the U.S. runs a large trade deficit. But there is enormous potential here that is still remains unexploited because the volumes of trade between the two countries are much lower. Now, the good thing is that there are no inherent conflicts on the economic front between the two countries. And this is very important in the broader strategic context as well, because your other two guests have pointed out that there is a natural alliance between the two countries. But this is a relationship that really is going to need a lot of nurturing on the economic and political fronts, because India needs to be convinced that the U.S. is more than a fair-weather friend. When you look at economics, there is a concern that, in fact, the U.S. may end up throwing its lot with China if the chips are down, even though there is a conflict between the two economies. In the context of political issues, again, there is a concern that if the chips are down, that the U.S. may end up pushing forward its alliance with Pakistan or China. So I think the issue is nurturing this relationship. And on the economic front, a lot has been done. But there is the concern that Indian markets are not fully open to the U.S. as yet. And on the U.S. side, there is the notion of job losses because of outsourcing to India. But the reality is, I think, a relationship between the two that is growing can actually help both countries enormously. The amount of talent flowing from India to the U.S. has, I think, helped the U.S. enormously in the past and will do so in the future. And I think the U.S. can actually help India in achieving a lot of its economic objectives, especially in terms of building up its high technology industry, building up its infrastructure, and so on. So I view President Obama's visit as a very good first step, but there's a long way to go.
Nick Burns, is there a reason, structural reason, economically or politically, that the U.S. has to choose or that India has to choose? I mean, can these three substantial powers all not politically and economically get along?
No, we don't have to choose. In fact, I would enlarge the circle. We've got to work with China, India, Brazil, Indonesia, the emerging powers. Because if you think about it, Tom, our great challenges are going to be climate change, terrorism, nuclear proliferation, poverty, pandemics. We cannot succeed as a country internationally if we're trying to go it alone or if we're isolated. So we have to build partnerships with all of these countries. What makes the U.S.-India relationship unique, as President Obama suggested yesterday in his speech to the parliament, is that we do have this democratic bond. World's largest democracy, India. World's largest, oldest democracy, the United States. That will, I think, help us weather the storms of disagreements that are inevitable. So we're not getting along with India very well on the world trade talks. We haven't worked effectively on climate change. We're going to disagree on a number of important issues.
Even your nuclear issue has not been closed with India.
Unfortunately, it hasn't. This was the landmark negotiation, probably the most important negotiation in the 60-year relationship. We made a major breakthrough in 05, 06, 07.
Remind us what that was.
This was a deal that to relieve the American sanctions on India's civil nuclear industry, in return for which India would submit to international inspections of its civil nuclear facility. It sounds quite esoteric. It was very important because these sanctions we had imposed from the 70s on were the most difficult aspect of the relationship. By lifting them and by bringing India into the middle of the nonproliferation system, we really broke the ice in this relationship.
The hope was what, for American exports and nuclear energy
to
India?
The hope that American companies would build civil nuclear power reactors in India, supply nuclear fuel. There's a bill in the Indian parliament that's holding it up. They need to modify that bill.
And what's stalling things here? Part of it is liability after the Bhopal incident of years and years
ago. Exactly right. And most of the international agreements would not expose companies to liability, but the on-site provider. The Indian parliament has passed a bill that's very weak in protecting investors, and so you're not likely to see many American or French or Russian firms invest if there isn't a modification of this law.
Eswar Prasad, is there a good faith issue here? Just take the nuclear front. The United States made a pretty big step with the agreement that Nick Burns helped to negotiate, but it's still not all wrapped up. Why not, Eswar?
I think to a large extent, many of these issues do get tied up in the domestic politics in each country, and this is precisely what has India worried, because many of these agreements do seem to shift with the political winds in the U.S., and that raises a concern in India that if India does not quite do the U.S. bidding but does create a strategic alliance with the U.S. and then is left high and dry when times are tougher, it's going to be very difficult for India, considering that it views itself as somewhat isolated, especially with China expanding its sphere of economic and political influence. So again, here I think President Obama has taken a very important step in terms of building this trust, and that has to be at the very high levels and at the technical levels as well. And I think there is progress here, but the Indians are still somewhat wary of this relationship because they're not fully convinced that the U.S. has no ulterior objectives in mind.
Noah in Newton, Massachusetts. Noah, you're on the air.
I just want to caution against, you know, proclaiming India as a counterweight to China or a natural, benign, democratic ally. I'm not waving the flag to be fearful. But I think it's important to understand that India and the U.S. have really very different interests when it comes to issues like Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iran, for example. I had a few friends in graduate school, Indians, very smart, educated, and sometimes they said a few, you know, flippantly that, you know, once Pakistan comes back under Indian control or influence, you know, the better it will be for all of us. So I just think Americans, we want to see India as we like it to be, but really they're going to pursue their own interests, which really don't always align with the U.S. Thank you.
Noah, thanks very much. Sumit Ganguly, let me come to you on that. I think I heard Richard Holbrooke recently saying that ultimately the Afghan situation may not be resolved until Pakistan and India work out their conflict. You know, our caller Noah is not so sure that this necessarily works for everybody. I mean, when you look at that triangle, Pakistan, India, the United States, is it really comfortable given the nature of a U.S. interest in Pakistan right next door?
I think, quite bluntly put, and I'll say this even though Ambassador Burns is on the line, the U.S. relationship with Pakistan is a transactional relationship. Our relationship with Pakistan is largely designed to give us access to Afghanistan, which we are getting rather fitfully, if I may be blunt. Since I'm not a policymaker or a former policymaker, right. I'm under few constraints, in fact, none. We are getting actually only very limited cooperation from Pakistan, and one doesn't have to look at classified sources to come to this inexorable conclusion. All one has to do is to read the press with some care. The Pakistani military has an E-Day fix about India. It also enables them to bolster their own position within Pakistani society. And even after India withdrew two divisions away from Kashmir in the last 2 years, it elicited absolutely no positive response from Pakistan and the Pakistani military. Pakistan now has a notionally civilian government, but for all practical purposes, real power still resides with the military. And isn't it odd that when every time President Zardari happens to visit the United States and Washington, he has General Kiani in tow, or perhaps it's the other way around, General Kiani has the president in tow. It would never happen that an Indian prime minister would travel with his chief of staff of the Indian Army to Washington. I mean, that would be simply unthinkable. It's beyond the realm of possibility. So the bottom line is, we need to be completely clear-eyed about the nature of the Pakistani state and the extent of cooperation that we in the United States can elicit from Pakistan. Unfortunately, I don't see such clarity on the part of the Obama administration.
Ambassador Burns, can the U.S. have it both ways? The president did not talk about Pakistan much in India on this visit, yet we've got a large relationship there. Sumit calls it transactional.
Right. And I think Noah is right, the caller, to suggest that we cannot anticipate a beautiful relationship with India where we have no differences. We will have differences. But on the largest issues ahead of us, including on Pakistan and Afghanistan, I think our interests with India are converging. That's why, Tom, I think the president was right to call for an expanded Security Council and for India to become a new permanent member. Why is that important to Americans? Security Council is the most important and credible political institution in the world. We have the veto. We're one of the five permanent mm-hmm. members. But those permanent members are the victorious powers of the Second World War. Mm-hmm. And so the Council reflects, if you will, the balance of power of the world in 1945-46. We live in 2010. We've got to tackle climate change and trafficking of women and children and poverty. And so, therefore, you need a capable, globally oriented democratic partner to help us confront all those challenges. And India, I think, is that country.
But let's look at that. It's a great applause line when you're standing before the Indian Parliament. Easy to say, though it hasn't been said before, but hard to actually do. Was it just a rhetorical offering to India? Do you see a chance in heck?
Well, I think symbolism is important. This was a highly symbolic gesture by President Obama. Mm-hmm. It's not going to happen tomorrow or next week or mm-hmm. next year. But it's important because the president was effectively saying, India is globally important to the rest of us and to the future of the world. Now, here's the problem. It takes 128 votes in the General Assembly of the UN to modify the UN Charter to allow for an expansion of the Security Council, and the politics and math of getting there is very difficult.
Does it take Chinese acquiescence?
It will, because each of the current Security Council members have a veto.
Right.
China doesn't want to see India in the Security Council, so we're probably looking in the next couple of years at a small group coming in to add to the Security Council, India, Japan, Brazil, and probably South Africa.
But without veto power, without
probably probably without veto power. They'd be permanent members.
Mm-hmm.
They would take their place with the great powers. But I think to extend the veto is probably more than the market will bear.
Let's go to Dival in Omaha, Nebraska. Dival, you're on the air.
Tom.
Hi.
It's great to be here. First of all, I want to say that, you know, India really, really appreciate Mr. President's acknowledgement on India as an emerging power. And as you guys are discussing that, Pakistan is the most vital issue in the whole matter for the relationship between United States and India. And, you know, like, if United States had previously aided Pakistan on so many reasons, and it's one of the biggest lands with the United States in Afghanistan war.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, India is looking at this as a threat, like, by aiding Pakistan in a military way, and they are looking at it will be a biggest threat to India in the future, and everybody knows that.
Dival, you're breaking up, but we've got that. Nick Burns, I don't want to skip the Pakistan piece for the Security Council here. How does the United States hold both of these relationships when the tension between India and Pakistan is still quite palpable?
Right. I think it's very difficult. It's a tricky balance. We have vital interests with Pakistan. We've got to get along with Pakistan because of the fate of our soldiers and our war effort in Afghanistan. And yet we have vital, I would say, longer-term interests with India. So what do we do? President Obama is a very skilled diplomat, as is Secretary Hillary Clinton. They can balance these two, I think, over the next couple of years. But ultimately, I think the United States needs to work harder and more seriously to help reduce the Pakistani-Indian differences, perhaps even not overtly, but perhaps even behind the scenes, encouraging a settlement on Kashmir in the next couple of years. Without that, this Pakistan-India relationship continues to be a problem for us and for many other countries in the future.
Eswar Prasad, let me drill in on the economy with you for a minute, because a lot of Americans, when they look at India, they know the story of this booming country, rising country economically, but there is clearly a lot of unease about what that means for Americans and American jobs. Just one example here off our website. Here's a comment from Nick. He says, I wouldn't mind outsourcing to India if, one, their work was as good as it worked done in the U.S. Try getting your computer fixed or bill straightened out over the phone with someone thousands of miles away. Okay, I don't know. And two, if the Indians bought American products. We sell all over the world, but India is the hardest country to sell to. Why is that? What do you say to those two, I think, fairly common perceptions, Eswar?
Now, first of all, I think it's reflective of a dramatic shift in the world order that you have the leader of a country that is about 12 times larger than the country that he's going to, which is India, which has a $1.2 trillion economy, and where the per capita income gap is about 45 times. So the U.S. per capita income is 45 times that of India. And yet the U.S. is looking to India for its own job growth. Of course, that reflects the dramatic pace of India's growth and its very strong potential. And I think if you look at job growth issues, really what the U.S. has benefited from enormously is this transfer of human skills from India. Now, it is true that there is some outsourcing going to India, but the big question in this sort of trade relationship is whether there are unfair rules, whether there are any subsidies or other currency practices, for instance, that are tilting the relationship in favor of India. So if India can compete more effectively in certain areas, like low-skill service sector jobs, it's not obvious that should be done in the U.S. Now, the other part of the issue is why India is not importing more U.S. goods. And it is true that there are certain parts of the Indian economy that are still relatively closed, especially in terms of investment, foreign direct investment into certain sectors. And there, things are slowly beginning to open up. But by and large, India is quite open to goods right now, because the WTO agreement that India signed on to has resulted in a substantial decline in tariffs. So it's not that the U.S. cannot get goods into India anymore, but that market is just still growing because the per capita income is 1,000, the middle class is growing, the opportunities are there. But I think this is not going to happen overnight. The potential for a very strong relationship is there, though.
Can the United States look to India as a market that does not emerge as China has, as a, you know, with a trade balance that's so heavily one way? And can it look to India as an economic partner whose growth can also benefit the U.S. economy as well?
This is where the U.S. has a much greater advantage in India, because India needs the U.S. for technology, for a lot of high-tech goods, especially in terms of the infrastructure that it is looking forward to. India wants to make a quantum leap in many of these technological dimensions, and it is trying to engage the U.S. Now, here again, the fact that many sensitive technologies could not be exported to India for U.S. security reasons was a barrier, and President Obama has very clearly signaled that those barriers will be broken down, which will again help in this relationship. But India is a very fast-growing economy, and I think this relationship is going to intensify because those markets are relatively open, but the U.S. Firms, I think, are in a good position to take advantage of this. Now, there is a big difference between the two economies, India and China. China is about four times larger than the Indian economy. The relationship with the U.S. is much more unbalanced. So I think this is where having India as a natural trading partner may actually help the U.S. a lot more than its relationship with China. And maintaining that balance between these two economies, as Mr. Burns said, is going to be the key challenge that this administration faces.
Let's get a call from Sandeep. Sandeep in Boston. You're on the air, Sandeep.
Thanks, Tom. Quick note, Tom, and a question for your guest. One is, one of the things which is driving the strategic need to talk with India is the growing influence of South Asians and Indians in the United States. Historically, it's been centered around technology professionals, but of late, as we see it, I'm the president of Network of Indian Professionals, a nonprofit group of North America, there is a lot more influence in social, cultural, and political circles.
Yes.
in the U.S. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we also see there's a lot of reverse brain drain happening, because not only because of the growing economic strength of India, but also because of some of the inefficiencies in immigration, legal immigration, whereas a technology professional has to wait 8-10 years to get a legalized status, a permanent residency within the United States. And I wonder if your guests can talk about whether that's on the table for these talks or not.
Thanks, Sandeep. Ambassador Burns, what about it? There are immigration issues, maybe both ways at this point, with a brain drain, as Sandeep says. Also, one of the issues out there is about American education and how active American universities can be in India. Have you seen progress on these?
Oh, I have. You know, I think this is an early test of the Republicans, the Tea Partiers, and the Democrats in Washington. Can we achieve a bipartisan consensus on immigration as a whole? And also this question of H-1B visas to bring skilled workers from places like India for our computer and high-tech industries.
Should Americans welcome that or fear that? Does that put American computer guys and gals?
I think that helps American companies to succeed and ultimately adds to American jobs, so I'm for it. But I just say this, Tom, there's an explosion of interest by American universities in Indian higher education. India is opening up its higher education sector. I actually run our South Asia program at the Kennedy School, and we're looking for Indian partners for Harvard University.
So in other words, an explosion of interest in American institutions having a footprint in India.
Exactly.
Are there
right.
obstacles to that now on the Indian side?
The Indians are lowering obstacles that have been in the way of that for many decades, and you see many universities, including my own Harvard University, looking for collaboration partnerships with Indian universities. Already, we have over 100,000 Indian students at our universities, the highest number from any country in the world, exceeding that of China. So this relationship is strong, not just because of the governments, but because of the people, the business people, the Indian American community, the students. So the grassroots, the foundations are very, very strong, and that's why I'm encouraged that this relationship will overall be healthy in the future.
Iswar, our time begins to grow short. Here's a post from the website by an Indian working in the U.S. after completing a Ph.D. It says the U.S. is the technology brain of the world, and then goes on to say, but the U.S. population should be ratcheting up and stop accepting that they can have a comfortable life by doing pizza delivery. Is there a cultural mesh here on the economic side, Iswar Prasad? Do you see things lined up for long-term compatibility economically?
Now, this is where the American competitiveness edge really lies, in creating and innovating new technologies. And I think India plays a very important role in this. About one-third of the H-1B visas handed out by the U.S. go to Indian professionals coming to the U.S. So I think India is playing a role in helping the U.S. to some extent maintain competitiveness. So I think India and the U.S. can partner in this because the U.S. has a huge lead. India has the skills that it could use also to develop in terms of promoting high technology. So again, here there is one more example of a natural alliance between the two countries, but which again will need to be carefully nurtured and get away from these broader immigration concerns that are trapping Indian immigrants in the midst of it.
Sumit Ganguly, we've just got half a minute here. What about it? Do you see India as taking the place, maybe as the, you know, if it's in the top two or three American, partners in this century, does India take the place of, I don't know, the UK or traditional allies? Does it have that potential?
I think that's a bit premature. There are a number of uncertainties that still remain in the Indian and Indo-American relationship. There are residual concerns that remain in India from the Cold War era. The Indian elite is quite divided in terms of how best to approach the United States. Though there is a dominant position emerging that wants to have good relations, there are people who are still caught in a time warp in India, and they act as a kind of a break.
Sumit Ganguly in New Delhi with us today from Indiana University. Thank you so much for being with us. Eswar Prasad, thank you for joining us, and Ambassador Nicholas Burns, wonderful to have you. Thanks to you all. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.